This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is Tech Talk and my name is Jeff Sandhu. As businesses leverage on innovation and digital transformation, Hitachi Vantara is a new business entity that unifies the operations of IT storage and IoT business and analytics solutions into one integrated business. So what are the trends in 2018 that you can bank on to gain its benefit? On the show with me today is...
Hi, Jeff. My name's Russell Skingsley. I'm the APAC CTO for Hitachi Vantara.
Russell, welcome to the show. Perhaps we can start by talking about what's going on in the enterprise IT sector with all this talk about Industry 4.0.
Okay, no problems at all. Very interesting question and certainly topical with many of our customers now. And, you know, it's probably worth thinking about what the other industrial revolutions were, starting with steam power in the first one, and then electrical power and mass production, I guess, was next. And then in the 60s, electronics and IT. And now I think the World Economic Forum refers to this fourth one as cyber physical systems, or what a lot of our customers would sort of consider to be the Internet of Things. And I think that it probably represents a great opportunity for a lot of our customers, especially in APAC, where industrialization, production, manufacturing, all of that sort of stuff is, you know, just sort of primed to take advantage of this type of approach.
But it's also very disruptive, just like any industry revolution. You talked about, you know, the steam power and, you know, and then maybe move to electricity and then the dawn of internet. All these were very disruptive. Do you see the same kind of disruptive elements within Industry 4.0 as well?
Oh, no question at all. And I think this is probably one of the things that is a key feature with a lot of the discussions with what I would now call our traditional customers. It's almost amusing now, really, to think about, you know, IT, enterprise IT customers being in the traditional bracket. But when you look at them next to, say, some of the more agile internet-based businesses that have a tremendous embrace of the idea of mining data for analytical purposes to gain insight about customers or a business model or whatever, it's very disruptive. And if you think about some of the traditional businesses that are being disrupted almost overnight by companies that, you know, basically have a great idea and an app and the cloud, you know, it's quite frightening, I guess, for some of our traditional customers, but also extremely exciting for those who are looking to embrace, you know, a more innovative approach.
Is that term, innovate or die, is it to that extent?
I think it is, yeah. I think certainly in some companies it's a case, or some industries, it's a case of innovate or die. I think for some other industries, I think they're probably not quite at the die stage yet, but they
what are those industries
going on in adjacent industries, and think about you know, how they might be able to embrace some of the approaches and ideas.
What industries did you feel have, you know, maybe a slightly longer lifespan?
Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about, I guess. One of the classic ones that always comes up in these types of discussions, and I no doubt on your very show as well in the past, has been things like the disruption to the taxi industry through Uber. And I think, you know, that's almost an obvious one, which is there is a feeling of innovate or die in the traditional taxi companies. They feel like they need to emulate the Uber approach to really survive. But then you look at some of the adjacencies and adjacent industries that have sort of benefited from the Uber approach without having to directly compete in that space. If you look at Uber Eats, for example, and Uber recently said that Uber Eats is now responsible for something like 10% of their revenue or something like that. If you're in the restaurant industry, Uber Eats is actually helping your business significantly. I remember sitting in a row of restaurants the other night and just looking at the guys from Uber Eats and Food Panda and, you know, you name it, sort of running in and out of restaurants, and I was thinking to myself, man, these guys have come up with a new model, a new way of doing things, But the beneficiaries are actually the guys preparing this food, and these traditional restaurants are seeing the benefit of this new innovative approach without really having to take it themselves. So, yeah, sometimes it's innovate or die, and sometimes it's almost like there is, you know, a symbiotic ecosystem that just sort of mutually benefits from all of this innovation.
Mm. And all these examples seems to be is the startups, is the smaller guys who come in and disrupt the larger enterprises. Are enterprises in Southeast Asia transforming themselves quick enough to at least keep up with the pace?
I think it would vary from enterprise to enterprise. I think it's almost about attitude, you know, and some even very large enterprises have a very sort of entrepreneurial spirit, and others not so much. And it probably comes down to their willingness to transform their own culture and their own way of doing things. And I think that there are some that do it really well in terms of trying to transform themselves, and there's others who really don't do it quite so well. You know, I was at an event a few weeks ago, and there was someone from the ANZ Bank in Australia. They were talking about how they're adopting agile methodologies, not so much in their software development, which of course is almost a given, but in their approach to their organisation. And they'd actually taken a completely different approach to the usual sort of hierarchical organisational structure. And they were building these much more sort of goal-focused, agile, smaller teams and empowering those teams to get on with the job of innovating. And it's probably no surprise if you look at, say, the big four banks in Australia, that ANZ Bank quite often is seen as the innovator, but it's kind of it's an attitude as much of it as anything.
So why don't every enterprise then move into that kind of mindset? What's been the challenge for them?
Well, sometimes it can be a political challenge internally, right? You've got you can quite often have, I guess, a power base within the organisation that really doesn't want to transform. And once you get that sort of mentality, it can be very difficult. There is that sort of feeling of, well, this is the way we always do things, and to change things up could be very, very difficult for them politically. And so I don't think there's a deliberate desire not to be on the cutting edge or not to be transformative, but sometimes it just can be extremely difficult because of organisational structure and, I guess, the will of senior management to make those changes. Mm. I think that, you know, the ability for certain companies to be able to attract the innovative, driving, tech-savvy talent that they would need to make those kind of changes, you know, is quite often hampered by, I guess, the culture and the attitude of the organisation. Mm. So as much as anything, it's a cultural shift.
Is there also probably a lack of understanding of how to go about it, how to move into this new era?
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. And I think one of the mistakes that quite often is made, and we see this sometimes with companies that we deal with that are looking to undertake, you know, some kind of transformation. Quite often this is popularly called a digital transformation these days. It's not really understood that it's a cultural shift. It's kind of felt that, hey, digital transformation is an IT project, so if we bring in some technology and we have a project, we'll become digitally transformed, right? But that doesn't really always apply. In fact, quite often it's not really just about being an IT project. It's about really understanding what's going to be the benefit of this approach to lines of business within the business. You know, there probably have been IT transformations of the past that have been predominantly technological and have been able to be handled successfully within the confines of the IT team. But when it comes to this, you know, this fourth revolution, or this, you know, this empowerment through data and insights through data, it really has to be something that is embraced across the entirety of the business to succeed.
And when you talk about innovation within the enterprise itself, I guess it's a good way to let's talk about Hitachi Vantara yourselves. It's a new business entity and you're leveraging on innovation, development and experience across Hitachi themselves. And we know that Hitachi has many different arms. So who are Hitachi Vantara and what do you guys do?
That's a really good question, and you're right. We're going through a significant transformation ourselves. I think a lot of people probably aren't even aware exactly how large Hitachi Corporation is. I mean, it's something like $100 billion a year of revenue across Hitachi Vantara, Hitachi Corp. And there's in the order of 1,000 daughter companies within Hitachi involved in all sorts of types of operational business. And if you look at Vantara, it has come from the recent merging of three Hitachi companies: Hitachi Data Systems, which has been predominantly involved with not just storage, but all sorts of IT infrastructure, but has been one of the key players in data storage. Hitachi Insight Group, which was the group that Hitachi created really to bring what they like to call social innovation and IoT and analytics to market. That's been folded into this Hitachi Vantara group as well. And finally, Pentaho, which is a company that we acquired specifically for its analytics and big data capability. Those three companies have been brought together where the vision for that company is to help our customers with getting more value out of their data. Not just the technical storage and handling of data and the systems associated with that, but also helping our customers to understand how they can make better use of their data. And if you add to that the fact that this company is part of the larger Hitachi group, what that does is that brings together a significant amount of operational technology experience information technology experience, brings them together in a way that I think is fairly unique in this IoT space. So, I guess it's an ambitious aim because, we're transforming from being what was predominantly a company selling IT infrastructure to a company that is hoping to be the gateway for the world, I guess, to have access to Hitachi's not only information technology capability, but its operational technology capability as well.
It's innovation within such a large enterprise. And you mentioned data there, which is, now they're saying data is the oil of the digital economy itself. What kind of questions do you sort of get more often than not when you talk to enterprises and trying to help them through this whole process? What is generally the challenges that they bring up to you?
Well, there's a number, right? But there's a few that just come up increasingly, all the time when I'm talking to CIOs in our customer base. The nature of the type of data that our customers are trying to leverage, it has been changing really quite significantly over the last 10 years. And let me try and explain what I mean by this. And I'll start with a bit of an anecdote, I guess, and that is I kind of characterize most customers' experience in the pre-Facebook era and the post-Facebook era. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I say that is because Facebook probably taught us, if there's one thing that they certainly taught us, is they taught us that a whole lot of data that we thought was useless is actually incredibly useful. Mm. If you think about what people do on Facebook from our perspective, if there is a Facebook post and it's not directly about us, we kind of think, well, that seems like a whole lot of useless data. People talking about their favorite colors or their favorite meals or the name of their dog or the type of car they drive or where they went on the weekend, all this sort of stuff that to us, because it's not happening directly to us, we kind of think, well, this is a whole lot of useless data. But Facebook was able to take these, billions of seemingly useless bits of data and actually start to be able to generate really concrete information about particular groups of people, about what people do, what they like, especially what they like to buy, all these sorts of things. And a lot of our traditional customers now look at that and say, man, we have been collecting data for so long, and yet we don't seem to be capable of pulling insight out of it in the way that someone like a Facebook has been able to. And I think it's, in many of our customers, it's kind of been like a light bulb going off in their head where they say, how do I make use of all this data that I really haven't been making the most of? And so for a lot of our customers, the conversation is exactly that one. I've got all this data which I'm kind of not really using. How do I use it better to make my business better? And this is, I think, one of the key things the customers are asking us about.
So what makes a data useful? We'll find out after the break. I'm speaking to Russell Skingsley. He's the CTO of APAC at Hitachi Vantara. And we'll be right back. BFM 89.9.
Before Friday materializes, BFM 89.9.
You're listening to Tech Talk, and my name is Jeff Sandhu, and with me today is Russell Skingsley. He's the CTO of APAC at Hitachi Vantara, and we're talking about the changes in the IT innovation space with Industry 4.0 and the trends within the space itself. Russell, we talked a lot about data, but what makes data useful? It seems like now every piece of data, about every data entry, every data set is vital in some ways, but surely there are some indicators to what actually makes data a good data.
Yeah, it's a good point. And I think one of the things that probably has been an inhibitor in the past is that a particular piece of data on its own may seem to be useless. But when you combine that with two or three other pieces of data and you see a relationship between them, that relationship or that implied piece of data that you can pull out of that relationship is actually what the useful thing is, right? And I think this is, you know, just to go back to my earlier example, I think this is kind of what Facebook taught us, is that if you have enough data points that are seemingly useless, once you use analytics, machine learning, artificial intelligence to draw out implications of inferences of those pieces of data, correlations of those pieces of data, that's actually where things become useful. Now, I'm not suggesting that all data is useful. There probably is some that, you know, really is not going to provide you much value. But I think the point for our customers is they don't really know what they've got or don't have, because in the past they've been collecting pieces of data, perhaps archiving it for regulatory purposes or compliance purposes or whatever, but haven't really been using it or even understanding whether there is any use in it when they try and correlate it with other things that they know. So I think that's been one of the challenges, is that a lot of our customers are saying, I've got all this stuff. I don't know whether it's useful or not. I feel like there might be some use there, but I really need help to be able to make use of this.
And you've also have a top five specific IT trends for 2018. And, you know, looking at this five trends that we have here, they're all related to data itself. But let's dive into some of these. Maybe let's talk about the adoption of IoT platforms. What's going on here?
Yeah. So, and I think this is a big one, and it's one that probably in the last couple of years, its time has really come. And that is that if we think about this, we're talking about this, you know, this massive amount of data. A lot of this data comes from the fact that people are so connected these days. Not only people, but machines and sensors and, you know, almost anything can be connected to the internet these days.
My toaster is connected to the internet.
Exactly. So there are so many things that are. And I think from a company's perspective, the value of that is the data that can be retrieved from those devices. And so, you know, you said your toaster is connected to the internet. I guess for a bread company, there could be something useful in the piece of data that it could pull from your toaster. I don't know, but that's possible. But I think one of the things about this, of course, is that with all these potential sources of data, It's becoming quite clear that if companies are going to be able to make use of this, they're going to need to have some unifying platform to keep all of this data under control. Because, and let me just illustrate this a little bit. If you think about how things have potentially gone in the past with, the blending of information technology and industrial processes, quite often what happens is you'll find an IT system dedicated to a particular part of an industrial process. The problem with that is that very rapidly you could end up with a very large number of discrete IT systems looking after a large number of industrial processes. It then becomes extremely difficult to be able to see a correlation between the data that exists on all of these discrete systems. And so the idea behind an IoT platform is to avoid that situation and say, why don't we think about a unifying common IoT platform into which we can plug a number of systems and then collect all that data in one place. The value of doing that is we can then use analytics to see correlations between all of those different sets of data. And so the idea here is to try and get ahead of the game a little bit and say, let's try and have a common platform for these potentially, you know, even unknown future IoT applications. But if we can just lay the foundation now, we might get ahead of getting ourselves into a bit of a mess.
Mm. The other trend is the wider adoption of video analytics. What's happening with video, and how are we doing video analytics here?
Well, video analytics is massive in this IoT trend. And, you could probably consider, if you think about IoT devices, the value of an IoT device is in the data that it can transmit back. And so, for example, you may have a sensor in a machine that measures temperature, right? It's fairly one-dimensional in terms of the data that that's going to return. It's basically going to return temperature, and that's all it's going to return. What's great about video analytics is you can probably think of a video camera as, you know, the most sophisticated possible IoT sensor, because once you combine that with video analytics, video camera combined with video analytics, it's almost infinite the number of types of data that you can pull from that video, because there are so many things that you can imply for something that you see. I mean, you can see objects, you can see movement, you can see changes in, you know, the light. You can quite often, if you have a camera that's able to move into the infrared spectrum, you can see temperature that way. And so the video camera is such a flexible and sophisticated IoT device. When you combine that with video analytics, it's almost infinite the types of things you can do. Mm. For example, you can have a video camera when married to video analytics. A video camera is something that would enable you to, for example, to detect if someone has left an object in a particular location. And so you can imagine for public safety users, the ability to be able to see, or to be able to, you know, see with 100% certainty or close to it, whether someone has left an object in a public space, gives you, you know, a degree of safety and potential warning of an event that you would never hope to be able to have if you just sort of have people hopefully watching that space at, you know, hopefully the right time. It's extremely powerful for IoT applications.
And to do all this has become a lot easier thanks to AI, right?
Yes, definitely. And so, you know, it's probably, you know, worth revisiting that analogy of the public safety space and watching the video cameras. If you think about the typical examples of the past of how we would do that closed circuit TV type safety situation, you would have potentially thousands of cameras, and those thousands of cameras would come into some kind of command and control center and feed, probably on some kind of cycling mechanism, say dozens of screens, and then in front of those screens you would potentially have a handful of people watching those screens. what you're really hoping for is that at just the right time, the appropriate feed from one of those thousands of cameras is on one of those dozens of monitors being watched by one of those few people. The probability of actually catching an event in that type of scenario is pretty low. But if you have computers watching those screens, watching every single one of those feeds simultaneously, you can take out completely that chance aspect, the aspect of chance, and you can bring certainty into it. What allows that to happen, of course, are technologies like machine learning and artificial intelligence. You know, you need to be able to, in effect, teach the computers what it is they are looking for in those video streams. And that kind of requires a degree of intelligence that, you know, in the past we probably didn't have access to.
And, you know, with all that, though, it kind of leads to a question that I have to ask, though. Are we going to be out of jobs then?
Well, I certainly hope not. it's a valid question. And, we talk about the four industrial revolutions or the four revolutions. Each one of them probably introduced that exact same question at the time, right? Is the horse and cart driver going to be out of a job because the railway system is so much more efficient in the steam era? You know, and yeah, you know, is the backyard manufacturer going to be out of business because the factories are able to aggregate all of this? So I think, you know, every single step along the way as we have these revolutions, I guess there are going to be people that are going to be impacted. But what you hope is that, you know, from a holistic point of view, it's going to free up humans to take, less mundane things disregard less mundane things and do more value-added things. So hopefully it means more interesting jobs for people in the future. But I guess time will tell on that one.
Are we moving in the right direction, for Southeast Asia market? Because it is, you know, one of the fastest growing market in the world.
Oh, it is. Yeah, no question. And, you know, it's interesting because, as you can probably tell from my accent, I'm Australian, but I've been living out here in APAC for the last 14 years or so. I spent 7 years living in Vietnam, and I've spent the last 7 years living in Singapore. And, you know, the rate of economic development in this region is absolutely stunning. And one of the things about it too is that in a lot of cases, these emerging countries are not bringing a legacy of old technology with them or even old attitudes with them. And so, you know, emerging economies look for the most efficient way to do something that is available right now. And so I find that APAC is probably the most likely region to adopt these, you know, most forward-looking technologies and approaches. So, yeah, it's a very exciting region to be in from the aspect of, you know, this fourth revolution. And I fully expect, you know, IoT is going to be, you know, the epicenter of IoT is probably going to be APAC, in my opinion.
Some nations in this region are just really hungry as well to innovate and to, you know, just have a better quality of life.
Ah, exactly. Yeah. And there's a real entrepreneurial spirit in countries that are emerging. Quite often these countries have younger populations, have a more adventurous sort of spirit, and, you know, they're reaching for the best way to do things, and quite often are early adopters, right? You know, when you think about where it absolutely amazed me. I remember when I first started living in Vietnam, the adoption of mobile phones in Vietnam was absolutely amazing. It was something like, you know, 1.2 mobile phones for every person. I'm like, man, there's a whole bunch of people who've got more than one, let alone one. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think this region is really hungry for innovation and doing things the latest and greatest way.
And with that, Dora, so what's your advice to the enterprises here in the region who are, you know, on their way with this, you know, digital transformation journey? What should they be keeping a close eye on and, you know, not get left behind, or just to fully benefit from this transformational shift?
I think that the main thing that I've learned really I guess between the companies that I feel are transforming well and those that aren't, is really the willingness to empower the people within your organisation that have the best ideas. I think that quite often there is, and I think this is quite often the case culturally, there is a feeling that all good ideas must come from the top down. But the reality of the situation is not all the best ideas come from the top down. Some of the best ideas come from people who are much closer to the working level of a company. And I think you need to make sure that you put in place the mechanisms required to be able to realise the innovative thinking of those people who are quite often closest to your business problems. So, yeah, it's almost kind of like flipping the pyramid in terms of where your great ideas come from. But in order to be able to do that, you have to empower those people who are, you know, probably traditionally followers rather than leaders. But I think, you know, it's a great source of great ideas.
I've been speaking to Russell Skingsley. He's the CTO APAC at Hitachi Vantara. And this has been Tech Talk on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.